HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 165, recorded live Thursday, June 18th, 2009. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. And by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott talks legacy code with Michael Feathers.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. I'm here in Oslo, Norway, at the Norwegian Developers Conference, and I'm sitting down in a reasonably quiet conference room with Michael Feathers, the author of Working Effectively with Legacy Code. He works for Object Mentor, and he knows all sorts of things that I don't know. So I said, I got to jump at the chance to talk to you. So thanks for sitting down.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I'm really enjoying the conference here. It's a great venue and lots of interesting speakers.
You know, and as with all conferences, it feels like the really interesting things happen in the hallways and happen between sessions. And Uncle Bob was talking about something, and the guys were brainstorming that someone was saying that they like to select chunks of code and within a long method, something that's maybe legacy code, and they like to go extract method using their refactoring tool of choice. Mm-hmm. And then that gives them a sense of what the inputs and outputs for that block are.
Yeah.
But in a method that maybe has three or four inputs, that might, from inputs as far as parameters into the method.
Yeah.
That might show them that they're really reaching outside the method and looking at global variables or bits of context. And that all seemed very kludgy to me, that maybe this person should be using a different kind of programming language. I mean, they're basically saying there's a lot of side effects that could happen here.
Yeah, yeah.
Shouldn't they be doing something else?
I don't know. I think that's the thing that we have to go and really ask ourselves very seriously in the industry right now. I spend a lot of time helping people with really ratty code bases, trying to go and recover. You know, and it's not atypical to have these big 3,000 line methods, and you have to go and try to figure out how to break them down and do various things. One of the things that I noticed is that side effects, are really a big deal. If you didn't really have to reason through side effects, you could basically make a lot of change much more effectively and much easier. So it just kind of makes me wonder. You know, it seems like we are making a move in the industry towards functional programming languages, and some of the dabbling that I've done with functional programming languages has really kind of led me to believe that this could be a bit of an answer. I mean, it's not going to be a complete panacea because there are always problems in development. But it seems like if we can get a control of the side effects situation, we might be able to go and do some really cool stuff.
Now, for those listeners who may not be, into this stuff and be really understanding it, we're talking about a way of programming that involves not changing something that's, not changing a variable that then you wouldn't have expected to get changed. I mean, how can we maybe explain that to us, about the notion of side
effects? A couple of hallmarks of functional programming. One is that functions are really first-class citizens. You can pass functions to other functions. The thing that's really important for us, like in this conversation, though, really is the immutability aspect, the notion that you really are working with constants all the time. Whenever you have a variable, you don't really reassign to it. You just go ahead and construct a new variable based upon the previous value and, do something computationally to produce that new value. One thing I noticed over and over again is that when you're looking at very long methods, it's the temporaries that get you, okay? When you have temporary variables inside the method and people are going in randomly updating them in various different places, those temporaries are just really kind of like a glue that make it really very hard to go and extract out pieces and make separate methods out of them. It's just really hard to reason through all that nonsense. When you have immutable data, then you're constantly constructing new values and you're able to see, like you were saying earlier, exactly what comes in and exactly what goes out. And your reasoning is easier. The reasoning is easier not only for you, but also for a tool that needs to figure out whether you can really extract a method or not.
Now, your book is about legacy code, but sometimes I feel like legacy code is code I wrote last week.
Well, yeah, then you're really in tune with the definition in the book, in a way. It's funny. I kept trying to find a decent title for the book when I was writing it, and I kept coming back to the notion of legacy code. I have a friend named Derek Mead, and I called him up one time. He was doing a gig with a new client. Mm-hmm. And I said, so how was the day today? And he says, oh, man, they're writing legacy code.
They're writing legacy code. They're creating it every minute.
And, I mean, that really struck me that, there's the dictionary definition of legacy code, which is code that you got from somebody else. But there's also this definition that we also feel informally, which is it's just code you may have just written it yesterday, but it's just intractable. It's really hard to work with. Mm-hmm.
Why is it intractable? I mean, nobody wants to admit that they're the kind of person that would create legacy code. And they might say, well, I inherited the system. I'm only able to write legacy code given the constraints of this system.
Yeah, and it's really a bit of a fallacy, though. You can always, in an old code base, make fresh starts with the new things that you write. You have to be really, you know, you always have a choice between going and adding five lines to an existing method and, you know, creating a new method that you delegate out to, you know, doing things where you have, you know, smaller structure and clearer, simpler structure and moving forward with tests and that sort of thing. It's tough because, you know, in the existing code, you're surrounded by badness, right? But, you know, it pays to learn design principles, learn good things about code structuring and make fresh starts in an existing code base.
Am I always going to find myself, though, spackling over something? You know, it's like, you know, when you buy an old house and you say, well, all it needs is a fresh coat of paint. And, you know, you put a couple of coats of paint over something, but you'll always know that there's mold and nastiness in the walls.
Well, you know, I think the truth of the matter is that for many large existing systems, you're never going to escape, you know, the structure that you've built up over the years, you know, but you can build new abstractions. You know, there's a really cool pattern that's been written up on the net called Strangler Application.
And Strangler?
Yeah, Strangler Application.
Like and, one who chokes someone to death?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And the idea is that if you have this big, you know, hulking mass of legacy code, what you can do is you can say, look, if we have events coming into the system, what we can do is we can divert some of those events to something which is really like a new system. And then the outputs from that end up going and being pushed out with the normal outputs. So you're taking certain things that come in and kind of diverting them off into this auxiliary structure, which is this new architecture that you're building up slowly with better structuring. And, you know, that can be good, but sometimes it just really ever becomes a complete thing. You're just building a secondary pathway in your application that allows you to do, you know, things in a better way.
Why is it called Strangler? I don't understand that.
Well, because it's kind of like you, it's kind of like a vine, a kudzu or something like that. It's kind of like growing, you know, over the application and sapping its strength, but becoming, you know, the thing itself, the vine becomes the stronger thing. So it's kind of strangling the existing structure. And
so you're imposing constraints on this.
Well, your hope is that the older pieces really just not end up going and doing things functionally for you.
I see.
That all the functionality moves
away
to the newer thing. Yeah.
That so they die like away. That.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So you build a system around it that strangles the old system.
Yeah.
Forces it to change or to go away.
And that's one strategy. Another strategy is to essentially just, you know, keep, you know, creating new classes and building new structure in the existing application without trying to go and create a parallel pathway. Mm-hmm. The third way of approaching things is to take a big, you know, area of code and try to go and write enough tests for it so that you feel that you can go and do some serious refactoring in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what I specialize in a bit with the book. It's trying to go and break dependencies in ways that are very conservative, so you feel like you aren't really breaking the application's behavior.
Right.
And then you're able to go and write tests against that, and with those tests, get a lot more confidence that you can start to refactor and make, you know, some really nice structural changes in the code that make your maintenance easier.
Hi, it's Scott here from Another Place in Time. I hope you're enjoying the show so far. I apologize for interrupting it, but I wanted to let you know that assembling a podcast like this every week isn't free. Certainly the bandwidth bill crushes us every month, so I want to let you know that this show is sponsored by Telerik. They make the show possible, and they make some pretty cool products as well. For example, if you're trying to build a Web 2.0 Ajaxy application, trying to use the Web 1.0 components, it's kind of difficult. You got to get the next-gen stuff if you want to build the next-gen websites, and that's exactly what the folks at Telerik have got in their new upcoming product, which is codenamed Rad Controls Prometheus. It's a big pack of web controls built entirely on top of the Microsoft ASP.NET Ajax stuff that you already understand. It's going to give you a lot of performance and interactivity on your next project. They mirror the ASP.NET Ajax API, so the development's really straightforward. Client scripts are shared, loading time is pretty fast. You set a couple of properties, you can even bind to web services for a really efficient operation. The new Rad editor for ASP.NET Ajax loads up to 4 times faster than before. And the RAD grid will do thousands of records in milliseconds. But, of course, it's better to try these things for yourself, so you can visit telerik.com/ASP.NET Ajax and download a trial. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll get right back to the show. So maybe I could ask you a question about, I was on site recently at a large company that had a legacy system, and the legacy system was in C++, and it was probably, maybe almost 15 years old.
Yeah.
But it worked, and it worked great. But it was legacy. It was legacy because it wasn't on the new shiny interfaces and whatnot.
Yeah,
it worked, and they had people actively adding to the system. Mm-hmm. But it was what I would call, and I don't know if this, I think I invented this. Hmm. Maybe I invented it in the case if I pulled it out of my butt. I have this caste system in my mind for APIs.
Yeah.
Third class APIs, like the ones that were written in the early 90s, were always dot execute. Mm-hmm. Or dot do it or dot master whatever. And you pass in a magic string and maybe it's tag value pairs or SQL, but it's something that the language that you're writing can't see.
Right.
It's some custom thing. And these are often in large systems that were multi-tiered. The only thing that we could easily marshal across the
strings
was strings.
Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they pass tag value pairs around. Mm-hmm. And that was a third class interface. Mm-hmm. And then like a second class interface might be something like a data set, which is a structure that organizes these, or a hash table, or a dictionary.
Right.
It's still not first class. Mm-hmm. And then a first class is like a proper interface. Mm-hmm. We ended up building, over the course of a week, a prototype that was a kind of a series of layers on top of this onion. Mm-hmm. The hope being that we would create data transfer objects that look closer and closer the way we wish they looked.
Yeah.
As they got out towards the outside to the service layer. Mm-hmm. And then in the future, we would remove the core of this onion and replace it with something better.
Yeah.
Is that a reasonable
way to do that? It is. It's reasonable. You know, because you're keeping the whole thing running while going and building a parallel structure that you're going to use to eventually replace something there. And so it's not quite the same as the Stringer application thing, but it is a very common strategy for large refactorings to do that sort of thing.
Okay, well, that's good.
Yeah.
See? I was only going partially through your book at the time, so I hadn't completed it.
Yeah, no problem. But that's a decent strategy with this sort of thing.
Okay, well, that's comforting.
It is a weird thing, though, to notice that for very old applications, you know, I feel like for some of them, you often have multiple ways of doing things that just end up coexisting. You know, it's kind of like you look around and you can say, oh, you know, man invented fire here, you know, and it's like, oh, man discovered wheel here, you know, and just you find the entire history of 15 years of software development stuck in one code base.
You know, now, do you enumerate the different techniques for working with legacy code? Do you have like any friendly mnemonics for something like that?
Yeah, no, not really. I mean, one of them is just like a modification of the test-driven development cycle. I mean, the typical thing with test-driven development is to say, you know, first thing you do is you write a failing test case, and then you make it compile, and then you make it pass, and then you refactor. I add another step to this, which is basically first thing you do is you break dependencies. Okay. Mm. You want to break dependencies in order to go and get the tests in place, in order to go and write the test and refactor underneath it and do along those lines.
That's really interesting because that's funny. One of the things that we found in this legacy system we were working on was that it had a dependency in this case on IIS.
Yeah.
On internet, on the internet information server, the Windows web server. That was profound.
Yeah.
So we decided to spend the first day mocking away IIS, basically making a test harness to lie to this old system. Mm-hmm. And once we did that, we realized that now we can start writing tests.
Yeah. No, and it's great. The thing that you realize after doing this a lot is it's kind of like most applications are really glued together. It's like they have hard-coded, you know, dependencies upon singletons and upon, you know, third-party APIs and all this other stuff that you can't really mock out, and you really need to be able to mock those things out in order to go and test some things in isolation.
Yeah.
You know, it's just really painful to go and have to go and have IIS running and the database running and all this other stuff and build your own little world just to go and run some simple tests.
It takes
too long to do, and you never really get the benefit of quick feedback from testing that you really need.
Is it a good idea to write lots of tests around a legacy system so you can make sure that it works the way you think it works?
Yeah, it's a good idea to, I mean, this is a first step, is to go and try to write tests around stuff that describe it. I call this characterization testing. You want to characterize the behavior so that you can refactor underneath and you can add new functionality and find out whether it's compatible with the old functionality. The thing I always like to go and underscore, though, is that you shouldn't really approach this and say, well, I want to write tests for everything, because for any large application, you know, you could spend your entire career going and writing tests for all this stuff. What you want to be able to do is develop the skill to go and do this on a spot basis. You want to be able to go and say, okay, well, look, you know, I want to change code here. So where do I have to write my tests in order to go and get a bit of coverage just to go and kind of understand as I'm working with this code, you know, as I'm trying to make it better, as I'm trying to go and add features to it, that I'm not breaking anything. And that
interesting. You know. We ended up calling this fear-based testing.
That's good.
We write tests around those sections that we are the most afraid of.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, I'm going in. All right, well, let's hang on. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm going to get your back, I'm going to need tests in order to feel not afraid.
It's good. And I think there's a level beyond that too, which is kind of cool. It's like once you're not scared anymore and you have the support to be able to get tests in place, you've broken dependencies, the step beyond that is to go and have curiosity-based testing. And people are quite often, you know, they often ask the question, it's like, how many tests do I need? And I really don't like to rely on coverage numbers all that much. You know, mm-hmm. I think coverage is a decent metric, but what I really want is the situation where people can say, look, I don't quite understand how this little piece of code works. Mm-hmm. And instead of going and trying to hunt through and read all through the code and try to figure out a mental model about how it works, what they can do is just write a test.
Right.
And they can write that test to go and say, oh, okay, now I've seen. I apply these inputs and it does this for me. And the cool thing with the tests, though, is that those tests remain in the code base. You can look at these tests and use them to go and really understand how pieces work intimately.
Right.
And, you know, that just makes it makes everything feedback-driven. It makes everything just exploratory and really much more pleasant.
It's funny. There's so many different words that you could put in front of hyphen-based testing.
Yeah.
You know, comfort-based testing, you know. From my point of view, anything that you can do that makes it easier for you to sleep at night.
Yes, definitely.
If it, you know, is a good thing.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day with all this, this is all about making developers' lives easier. And, you know, the cool thing is you make developers' lives easier and it's good for the business also because you can end up having, you know, faster feature development and, you know, more maintainable systems.
Exactly. You know, so lots of people have legacy issues, but at the same time, you've got these systems that you want to maintain, but you need or you want to get involved in the new stuff. And I've got this archetype that I've used a number of times on the show. And I've actually got a buddy in who lives in this area of the country who always laughs when I use this. And I say, I've got this guy. I call him the chief architect of the Nebraska Department of Forestry. And it was a silly archetype that I threw out a while back, but I'm realizing it's more interesting than I thought. Because here's a guy who's got an important job, if a small job.
Mm-hmm.
But he's got legacy systems that people are counting on. He matters. His systems matter.
Mm-hmm.
But he's an alpha geek. He wants to get involved in the new stuff. Maybe he's running access databases from 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But he's smart enough to understand what he's missing. How can he use some of these techniques to get, you know, make sure that he's meeting his job's needs and his constituency's needs while still getting involved in the new technology?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it comes back to something which is kind of interesting that I ask every once in a while when I visit teams. It's like, when's the last time you wrote a new class, right?
Mm.
And it's funny because in some places, it's like people don't really write new classes all that often. They just go and add code into existing methods. You know, they add methods on existing classes because they kind of feel like they're in maintenance and design is over. But I think that's one of the worst mistakes you can make in software development is to feel that design is over. It's really a continual process. And even in the oldest systems, you should be creating new functions and creating new classes.
You think it's a rule of thumb? Don't stop?
Yeah, don't stop design. I mean, design is a continual process of examination and reexamination and evaluation and
change. But
what if
I've got some system in VB6?
Yeah.
Should I be still developing in VB6? And
well, you've got to make a change, you know, make a decision. You may want to go and move to VB.NET or move to C# or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you stay in VB6, you've got to recognize that all the choices you're making are really design decisions and that you should try to go and use, you know, good principles and make good evaluations and do good things.
It's interesting though, but that I'm thinking about again with fear. You know,
yeah.
I don't want to mess it up. I don't want to break it.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things where if you haven't got into the build deploy cycle, if you've fallen out of even for 6 months, even a 6 month old or even a 3 month old system, I may be afraid to deploy it for the sense that I might, I don't know, make the gods angry.
Yeah, well, you know, one thing to point out, though, is it's like if you're scared of making changes in a big, long method, right? And that's, you know, it really is a very scary thing.
Mm-hmm.
Some changes that you make can be articulated as new methods, right? You can go ahead and say, look, let me create a new method. Let me go and delegate from the big old method to this new method.
Mm-hmm.
And what's cool about that is that you have a new context, right? This is a completely different new context. You can pass variables in and write code that, you know, that just, you know, deals with those particular parameters and do it using test-driven development, which is a great thing for your architect to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you want to get into something which is new. Well, TDD's been around for quite a while, but for many people, it's new.
Right.
Practicing test-driven development is a wonderful practice. And, you can build up new things in the context of old systems. And, you know, really, if you can delegate out to something else and build it up as a new structure, that's a very valuable thing to do in the context of old code.
You know, I'd be interested if there are people who are listening, who are maybe using older systems, maybe older versions of FoxPro or older versions of VB, who have written test harnesses.
Yeah.
Like, is there a VB6 test system?
Yeah, there. I know there's
a 6-unit.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and I hope it's still there. But there's a XP programming website by Ron Jeffries that contains a list of all of the variations of the XUnit testing framework. Okay, and you know, we call it XUnit, even though there's actually like a brand XUnit now.
Oh, yeah.
But like everything which is basically adopting the same architecture that JUnit did. It was one of the very first early testing frameworks. There's CPP unit, there's NUnit, there's FUnit for Fortran, you know, every language you can imagine. Yes.
Rock on.
There really are. So it's just a matter of going and doing a little bit of digging, but you know, chances are the language you're working in has there's an HUnit for Haskell.
It's funny. I date myself by coming back to VB6. I started in C and in C++, but I didn't think about unit testing back then. Mm-hmm. This is like
many people didn't.
Yeah. You know, 89, 90 in that area, and then VB3 came along. But for me, the fat part of the bell curve was VB6.
Yeah.
Of the bell curve of my career. Mm-hmm. So I mean, I think about like, man, that's when I really got a lot done.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of really crappy stuff, and God help the people who have those things that I wrote, but.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to go back and instrument that code and get that the same feeling that I get with unit testing today.
Yeah.
And the feeling of productivity I had at that time and combine those things.
It's very possible. I know teams are working in Delphi and they're basically doing unit testing and I mean early Delphi as opposed to the later .NET stuff. And,
I was so productive in early Delphi. Yeah. It was great stuff.
Yeah, no, it's a cool language. It's a bit different, a bit off the mainstream because it's a Pascal derivative, but yeah.
Where do you find yourself writing code in? Are you in all systems? I mean, you consult, right?
I'm a consultant and I go around to many different teams. The thing that I find rather interesting is that I'm called in quite often now for C and C++ teams. And the main reason I think is because the problems are harder. You know, particularly in C++, it's like the work that it takes to go and break dependencies to get tests in place is really kind of tough. The language wasn't really engineered for that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's really interesting. The system I was working on last week was a C++ system.
Yeah.
And we had situations where they had a specific compiler and a specific version of the compiler, and their exports were a certain way. They were memory model things. They'd replace the memory manager.
Yeah.
You can't just go and say, hey, compile it.
Yeah.
You had to set up the build environment, and that in itself was...
Yeah.
A task.
It's really tough. And I think the thing that I really hope for most teams that are out there now that are working with, you know, current technologies that they do is try to maintain the upgrade chain. Try to upgrade your language periodically and, you know, try to upgrade your libraries. You know, it's terrible when you visit teams and they're like 3 or 4 versions behind because, you know, the more versions you fall behind, the harder it is to go and catch up again. And you really just pull yourself out of the path of a lot of goodness.
Right. And you're not necessarily upgrading just because it's new and shiny.
No, but just basically to keep yourself in the path of new tools and new technologies and stuff like that. It's not the worst thing in the world to go and fall completely behind on some of these things. You can still do some cool stuff. But it's just so simple to upgrade. I mean, it's a great discipline to go and keep upgrading because you deal with different change cases and it basically increases the robustness of your code.
Yeah. Well, it looks like we've got to get going because we've got to go to another session right now here at Norwegian Developers Conference. I really appreciate you sitting down to chat.
Well, thanks a lot. It's been great. Really good conversation.
Well, check out Michael Feather's book, Working Effectively with Legacy Code.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been another episode of Hansel Minutes. I'll see you again next week.